My name is Margaret Shorter. Welcome to this temporary makeshift studio in my home here in Delta, British Columbia. My guest today is retired Corporal Jane Hall. Jane is a former police officer with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, a serving member and director of the Vancouver chapter of the RCMP Veterans Association, and the author of the book, The Red Wall, A Woman in the RCMP. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
Jane, you acknowledge in your book that your decision to apply to be a police officer, even before women were being hired into operational roles in Canadian police forces, was, in your words, naive and maybe even arrogant. By challenging the status quo in the 1970s, your ambition could be construed as having been the product of an emerging feminist movement. In The Red Wall, at one point, you appear to be reassuring yourself that you're not one of those women's libbers, quote, quote. Would you describe yourself as a feminist, do you think?
I am now, and I didn't really understand the definition of the word, and I think I was back then as well. In the 1960s, I think the feminist movement was painted in the media as being something that was negative, something that was extremist, something that was anti-male. And to be a feminist was not a positive. And it wasn't until much later, after the book, as a matter of fact, when I was encouraged and educated by some feminist professors that I am actually a feminist, that it took me a while to realize that actually I am. And then I realized that some of the best mentors I had were male feminists. And I think I learned to be a feminist from men as much as from women. It's just a matter of fairness.
A male feminist. Do you have male feminists in your life?
Yes, I think my husband, he's very supportive of everything that's fair and no tolerance for anything that's not. And so he's definitely a male feminist. My staff sergeant, Tom Hill, back in the 70s, believe it or not, he was really fair, and he didn't see the gender issue as something that was a weakness. He saw it as a strength right from the beginning. So I would identify him as a feminist.
Early in your book, you talk about your first experiences at the RCMP Depot Training Academy and being told of the expectation that as a troop, you would be, quote, striving for perfection as a unit rather than as individuals. You describe this process as each troop's identity being molded out of the total blend of individual dispositions, giving rise to a new collective personality, a personality distinct from any other troop before or after. You also said at that time that there was a touch of anarchy in our souls, which made us more likely to test the rules than follow them. Males joined to maintain tradition, we joined to challenge them. In hindsight, I'm wondering whether all the women in your troop held that same view, or whether it was more a personal perspective that may not have been universal among female recruits.
Well, I got to say that there was a group of about five of us that probably were the anarchists. And I confess to being there in that thick of it. And I got to say, we had a lot of fun breaking those rules and figuring out the ones we had to follow and then figuring out the ones that would have been just so much fun to break. And it did stress out some of the other members of our troop that were a little bit more compliant, shall I say?
Mm-hmm.
But it just added to our experience there. I mean, you've been through Depot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a wonderful institution, and it certainly is something that every member of the RCMP is very proud to have gone through. And we all do it as naive young people, and to survive it. I mean, it's testing physically and mentally and emotionally, but. To have a little bit of fun along the way, you only go around once in life.
In training, to stay with Depot for a few minutes, in training, when you were ordered, you literally jumped in the deep end of the swimming pool even though you couldn't swim. You believed, as you said in the book, surely I would not drown with so many people focusing their attention on me. This could be described perhaps as either foolhardy or having faith in your fellow human being. You had been identified as someone who could overcome their fear and survive. Through the book, as you gain service and experience, this attitude seemed to me to look more like what today might be described as that of a risk-taker or a leader. How did that attitude play out for you during your career? Did that serve you, or was it detrimental to you?
It served me all the way through until, I would say, the last few years of my career. Because it was just, I think a risk-taker might be an adequate label to what I do. But I would try to overcome the situation that I thought I couldn't do and find a way to win. And I have to say that within the force, I managed to win, not always by myself, with a lot of help as well, too, and dance my way out of just about every dangerous situation I ever got into and most hostile situations as well, too. And so it was, yeah, it was an attitude that kept me going. If I hadn't jumped in back at Depo, I probably would have, forgive the pun, washed out early in my service. It taught me that that you know I could trust the other members that were around me. And if you do trust as a group, then you can accomplish a lot more.
A theme emerges quite consistently in your book, which highlights the skills and abilities that female officers in particular brought to law enforcement. You've alluded to this a little bit already. 5'4" was the minimum height requirement for female officers when you joined, and you didn't quite make 5'5", as I recall. What were some of the strategies that both kept you safe in such an unpredictable environment as frontline policing, and that gave you credibility as part of the red wall, or in the American vernacular, the blue line?
Well, I found it being a female, and particularly my size, where I couldn't be mistaken for a man, because, I mean, all the males were at least 5'8", and most of them were 6 feet tall, so to see the police car pull up and a police officer in uniform get out and my size, and I looked like I was 14. I definitely was female. So right away, that was a huge distractor if you were walking into a fight, because they were all expecting the big Mountie to come in, and instead they had what they saw was a young female come in, and with a big smile usually, because that's very disarming as well too. And it's really surprising what I found interesting, because I do come from a really isolated small community. We don't even have police. I mean, it's
Wolf Island in Ontario.
Wolf Island, right, Ontario. Right. So I really hadn't encountered criminals before I joined the force. So they were a completely unknown quantity to me. But I just decided that I would treat them with the respect that I would treat anybody else and see if they rose to the occasion. And they did. It was so surprising, and none of them saw themselves as bad people. So if you come in and you make the eye contact, you have the big smile, you talk to them, and you expect them to behave well, it's remarkable how many of them just rose to that occasion. So I could say that it was nothing but an advantage, and it was also you de-escalate the situation right away.
You were very tactful in your book, giving nicknames to those you encountered through your career who were challenging or whose performances were less than stellar in your opinion. They got names like Corporal Highbrowns, Constable Mischief, Constable Sleepy, and even Frickin' Frack, with whom you exchanged some of those practical jokes you talked about. You also named and gave credit to those whose actions were positive or made a difference to you in their work, for the organization, for the profession, even at the political levels in your country. In this country. Why did you do this? And do you think that you would have been this diplomatic if you'd written the book sooner?
I think I would, and just to set the record straight, Frick and Frack were good guys. The whole point of the book wasn't to tell my story, because I really believe that my story was a lot of people's story. It was my generation's story, where social changes were happening so quickly, that things that were happening to me were happening to other police officers, male and female, in the RCMP and in other police forces, and in nursing and in teaching. There were a lot of changes going on. So what I was trying to do was not, this isn't a get-even sort of book, so I certainly didn't want to call down anybody who, in my opinion, didn't behave in the best traditions of the force, but I also didn't want to leave that out of the book, that, as I said, I'm just an average person, and this was happening to a lot of people. So I think my observations and experiences were kind of common to a lot of people, so I wanted to make sure that that was going through. It wasn't about me being the best cop in the world, because goodness knows I'm not, and it's not me about me at all. It's more about, let's stop and discuss what's happened in the last 30, 40 years. Look, how far have we come? And we've come a lot further, but there's certainly a lot more room to improve.
In The Red Wall, you write against the evolving backdrop of Canadian society. And in your opinion, one of the great game changers in Canadian law or justice was the arrival of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. You referred to yourself as a converted Westerner by this time. You were feeling the erosion of the nationalistic beliefs of your youth. You refer to the Charter in your book as the Charter of Wrongs and state the Canadian justice system and its servants, the RCMP and lower court judges, had been neutered. What did you mean by that?
Well, and I've had some time to think about that, too. That's strictly a police point of view, not a feminist point of view. The first 5 years of my service were pre-charter. And when the charter was coming in, I listened to some of the old staff sergeants talking about how it would have such a profound impact on the justice system, and I thought they were overreacting, because we had a common law justice system, and the overriding principle in that justice system was the as long as the administration of justice was not brought into disrepute, then justice would be served. And what that meant was that there was a bit of license that was granted in situations and crimes that were very serious, like murder, rape, armed robberies, anything where the public was at risk. And the judge was expected to apply justice. Now, when the charter came in, it was, and by the way, as a feminist point of view, the charter is good. If it hadn't been for Marie McTeer being married to Joe Clark when they were doing the drafting, who enshrined female rights into the charter, we'd be in a much worse situation in Canada. So from a female point of view, I think the charter is very good. But when the charter came in, it was drafted, they knew their civil law, but they didn't have any understanding, I think, how it would be used by defense lawyers. And the crowns are so overworked. In Canada, you can cite British law or American law if we don't have Canadian case law. Mm-hmm. But the crowns are so overworked that they were being outgunned by the defense lawyers. So we had a lot of poorer case law being set in the 80s that made it so that this idea of going to court and letting a judge actually decide who was guilty and who was innocent and protecting the public trust in the justice system seemed to be cast to the wayside, and the process, the law, became more important. So if there was a breach in the law, somebody didn't cross a T or dot an I, somebody waited too long before the trial was heard, had nothing to do with whether or not they were guilty of a rape, or mm-hmm. then it was thrown out, and that eroded the faith in the justice system with the public. And that's what Canadian law was built on. So we have come back from that. There has been some really good case law at the Supreme Court level, and I think it's balancing out.
Jane, through the book, I was struck by your optimism, your hopefulness, your resiliency, and your commitment to the force as an entity, to your faith, and to your values. I was disappointed when you finally left after 21 years of meritorious service that you achieved while also part of a two-mountie marriage raising 3 children at that time. I was glad you made it to pensionable independence, which was one of your goals, but disappointed that you felt you could not continue your life on its current path. It felt to me like a slow accumulation of things that happened for you both inside and outside the force, an erosion from within and a corrosion from without, if you will. Am I right in what I picked up from the book there, that your reasons were both personal and maybe organizationally systemic for leaving?
Yeah, I love how you have a very good way with words. You should consider writing yourself.
I needed to prepare for you. I knew you were good.
In the end, actually, it was, I kind of copped out because it's a lot more socially acceptable to say that you're leaving to focus on family, and that, yes, it was, you know, some of the work contributed to it. I would say that it was like an 80-20 split, and it was my disappointment in the force organization, never the people, that I didn't feel that it was adapting to the situations the way it was going to be positive for the members. So I actually left more because of my disappointment in the force than the stresses of my family. But again, like so many women, it was a lot easier to say, yeah, I had 4 children, so I left the one of my 2 full-time jobs, and they were 2 full-time jobs. But in honesty now, in retrospect, I should be a little bit more forthcoming, and I would say 80% was my disappointment in the organization of the force, the leadership at the top, not ever in the members that I worked with.
And that's where I was going with that. You've used the book, The Red Wall, A Woman in the RCMP, to implicate the leadership of the RCMP in the ending of your policing career. That's how it felt to me. Do you think leadership in the RCMP has changed since you left or since The Red Wall was published? I would say that I would like to see improvement. I don't think that it. I think that actually we had better leaders when I was getting disappointed. I have to set the record straight for Commissioner Inkster. I was a little harsh on him because I thought that he wasn't standing up enough to the politicians, but I should have acknowledged more that he was always a friend of female members and a big supporter of them. And if I ever finish the book or do the sequel, then I'll set that record straight. For right now, he was much more positive than such political headwinds in Ottawa that bring pressures on our senior executive. And I'm a firm believer that there are three things that as Canadians we should hold dear and have as guardian institutions, and they should be beyond trying to run them like businesses. And one's the justice system, one's the healthcare system, and one's the education system. And as long as those three serve Canadians, we pay a lot of taxes and we should have good leadership there, and they should serve us. So I guess I was an optimist, and I still am an optimist, but I had that. I was kind of disappointed in the ending part of the book as well, too. That wasn't how I envisioned leaving the force, and it wasn't what I had envisioned, but I had to write it. The RCMP continues to struggle with understanding issues that affect women police officers, as you've said. A number of aggrieved female officers, some still serving and others who have left the ranks, have launched a class action lawsuit against the force alleging harassment within the ranks. In your opinion, what is happening in the organization? And as you suggest, why are there no significant numbers of female members in the commissioned ranks representing women, or at a minimum showing by their very presence that these challenges can be overcome?
Well, I will say that it's a leadership issue. It's absolutely a leadership issue. And if the force approaches it as a leadership issue, backs it up with training and backs it up with discipline, and ties in the promotion system, that it will improve not just for women but for men as well too.
Well, I'm glad though that you've kind of brought it out. What I was leading to is it's not just the harassment issue, although the focus is on this suit. It's become the issue of bullying in the organization has come to the fore. And so men have a vested interest in what's coming out of this as well.
Well, if you take a look at the pension issue that came out and Brown's report, I mean, it was men that were coming forward. And what they were complaining about was bullying as well, too. If you look at some of the recent complaints about past commissioner, again, it was a leadership style. It all comes back to leadership. And it's caught the media attention because the most recent thing that came out was sexual harassment and sex cells. And so it's been all across the media. I think that this is a leadership issue. I think that that's what the issue is. That's not very sexy, but if they can standardize and get credible training to their executives, and to all of the force to understand that this is what leadership looks like. It's not ducking and running from a problem. It's making sure there's a positive work environment. And if you don't do that for your people, you're not a leader.
Is a risk take is a true leader a risk taker?
Yes. I'm here.
Yes. Yes, you are. And I'm thinking that perhaps it's that sort of double-edged sword where you're encouraged to take risks, but you're also encouraged to toe the party line or to stay within the red wall that you've talked about. And it's knowing when to do that and finding the people that will step out in the public face and say, no more, that this, no matter what happens to me, I'm prepared to risk that so that things will change. I think that, for me, that's what I'm hoping to hear from somebody.
Yeah, it should never come to that, but it has come to that. It's come to that in the last 5 years. It came to that when my book was published, when we had people coming forward with that pension scandal. They broke ranks within the RCMP, and that had never happened before. And I commend the people that did that because they're the heroes. They took the huge career risks that paid the price in some cases. In a good organization, you should tolerate dissent. You should embrace it. There should be a diversity of leadership at the top. And, And we have to standardize the training for leadership. We have to make it very clear. I mean, the force attracts natural leaders, and too often we rely strictly on that. We have to have, as an organization, clear policies and standards and educational opportunities for, especially when you're getting to the NCO rank and the senior executive and the junior executive as well, too, that everybody's on the same page. But again, if it's not backed up by the promotion system and by the discipline system, it doesn't mean anything. It has to be that triangle of training, discipline, and promotion. Put it all together. And if everything is on the same page, you're going to have a very strong organization.
Jane, you've recently launched a new website. www.redwall, the name of the book, Jane Hall, redwalljanehall.com. And I understand that the numbers of visitors to the site have jumped exponentially in its first weeks online.
I'm pretty impressed with that.
Congratulations on that. Jane, I know, knowing how I agonized about whether to join the RCMP veterans with you, something I perceived and feared would be yet another old boys network, I want to thank you for your continued optimism and for encouraging me to participate. For some reason, you still have an unwavering belief in our collective ability to change the environment of policing for women. You turned the question around for me so that instead of asking why should I join that organization, to asking why wouldn't I? There will be many more female veterans to come, and I think it's we can make it easier for them. I want to thank you, Jane, for joining me in this conversation. The interview will be posted on Jane's website shortly at www.redwalljanehall.com. You will also be able to link to it by visiting the website for the International Association of Women Police at www.iawp.org. And Jane and I are hoping to have a link posted on the website for the Vancouver chapter of the RCMP Veterans Association. And this is at www.rcmpveteransvancouver.com. This is an open site where you too can learn more about the life of policing veterans. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you for having me.